Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Nasiri, and each week I interview military veterans about their civilian career. Today's episode number 49 with John Corals.
In the private company world, I mentioned that these companies are typically on 2 to 2.5 year funding cycles. If you don't get the next check in, you know, the entity may go belly up. The person that feels the most pressure on that situation is the CFO, because you're looking at payroll, you're looking at vendor payments, you're looking at office lighting, and you've got better visibility into when things reach what's called cash exhaustion than anyone. And you expect CEOs to be very optimistic, heads of sales to be very optimistic and believing it will come. But when you're not seeing it, when you're not holding the sales order, and you've got a backlog of payments, that can be pretty nerve-wracking. But you can also thrive on the fact that in some situations, the weight of the company is on your shoulders. And for me, that's highly motivational.
The top two reasons to listen to today's episode are, one, finance. John has attained the pinnacle of one career path within the functional role of finance, the position of chief financial officer. In this capacity, he has raised over $150 million in financing. He talks about what it's like to be CFO, how he got there, and what he learned along the way. Number two, SEALs. John is a Navy SEAL, and no matter how many I meet, it's still pretty cool. He's a great example of how determination and drive can help get veterans ahead. As always, at beyondtheuniform.io, you'll find other great episodes and resources. You'll also find the show notes for this episode, which provide links to websites we discuss on the show, as well as timestamps for each topic we cover. So let's dive in to my interview with John Corals. Well, joining me from the Bay Area today, my guest is John Corals. John, thanks for joining me.
Justin, thanks for having me.
So I wanted to give listeners a quick background on John. He served as the chief financial officer, or CFO, for two different startups, where he has raised over $150 million of equity and debt financing for his companies. John is a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy. He served as a Navy SEAL as part of SEAL Team 8. After he transitioned from the military, he worked as a consultant at Accenture for 1 year prior to attending Harvard Business School. After HBS, he entered the finance industry and began his progression towards CFO. So, John, maybe to start things off, for someone on active duty who might not be familiar with what a CFO or chief financial officer is, how would you explain that role to them?
A great way to start here, Justin. So CFOs can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. I think at startups, it's well understood that you're going to be a guy who's reporting, a guy or gal who's going to be reporting historical financials, managing budgets. And that's kind of the basic stuff. The way I view the CFO is it's a role to really drive alignment of business activities to strategy. And CFOs in our positions, we have kind of unique access to information, not just financial, but business metrics, operating metrics that might come from marketing, from the product team, et cetera. The real trick in being a good CFO is to take that information and have it inform the rest of the business about what's working well, where there may be issues or problems, what's coming in the future that could be an opportunity or a potential challenge to the business. And for CFOs, with a mandate to control resourcing and put every dollar towards its best use, when you're able to provide those assessments, you can build a lot of confidence in an organization, and you build a lot of confidence in your investors, which is critical for private companies and VC-backed companies. And ultimately, when you're doing that right, what you get are really good forecasts out of a business, and then execution to those forecasts. If you're converging on that outlook or exceeding it, your employees are happy, your investors are happy, and more often than not, the customers are happy as a consequence. So that's kind of, I think, CFO in a nutshell.
That's awesome. And how does that translate? I know there's no typical day, but if there was, an average day, what does it look like in terms of when would you get to work, and what sort of activities would you do throughout the day?
So the reality is, for CFOs of smaller companies, there's not much of a defined start or end to the day. And as you said, things can be varying from day to day and hour by hour. A lot of that comes from the fact that startups and small businesses typically have way more challenges, opportunities, things to work on than the resource to go after. So the trick is really prioritizing and figuring out, okay, what do you need to work on now? What things aren't critical to work on right now? Because that helps you get a sense for what things are going to kill you. And those are the things you got to definitely focus on. But the big trick is understanding what's important to work on now, what you can push off and what you shouldn't be working on. And that's a lot of focus. So how does that drive my day to day? Well, at most companies that are sub 50 million in revenue, the trick to getting the business to scale and continue to grow is the interfaces around sales and marketing and getting sales and marketing efficiency working. What does that mean? It means really helping the sales team, helping people generating customer demand using a variety of marketing tools, both traditional and internet and technology enabled tools. It's getting those pieces working to in a way that enables a sales team to be effective and be productive and not wonder if they reach out to the customer, are they actually going to get somebody at the end of the sales process to buy things? This is the most common kind of challenge for companies selling and B2B, business-to-business software. And so it's a lot. It's a numbers-rich arena. Things can be very quantitative, and you'll find CFOs tend to have a lot of involvement there, because when the parts start working, you're going to want to increase resourcing pretty significantly. But that can be one part of the day working with either of those teams or together. It can also be diving into a product roadmap meeting with a technology team to figure out, is the architecture scaling? Are you going to have cost problems in the future? Do you need to find, different vendors to help solve some scaling challenge with infrastructure? It can be kind of all over the map, but what I generally try to do when I start the day is look at my calendar, and I challenge my team to do the same and ask ourselves, okay, how are we helping other departments grow and accelerate their execution? If we can't answer that, we've probably got the wrong set of meetings on our calendars. And CFOs, because we do get mired in a lot of minutia, we can be overwhelmed with a lot of back end stuff. And the trick is to manage that to a reasonable level while getting in front of some of the bigger business issues and providing a financial framework and a financial perspective to help our engineers or our marketing leaders or our customer success people make better decisions.
That's great. I mean, it seems like one thing that would be exciting about a role as CFO is you're just involved in every aspect of the company. Because you said, you have these finite resources. And so any resource you give to one department has to come from somewhere else. And so it seems like you'd have to be up to speed on product and marketing and operations and customer support and just knowing every facet of the company and knowing what they need. And it almost seems like you're the one with a couple feet back where you're seeing the overall organization and all the complex movements within it and having to make the call of which team is going to get more or less support. And I imagine that's quite a complex juggling act, but it really requires you to be conversant about every facet of running a company.
It certainly does. And there's no way you're going to be able to get super deep into the intricacies of how specific lines of code work in a data center. But you should be able to have metrics and other kind of indicators that give you a sense and the team a sense for how things are working or what the milestones are supposed to be in the future. And if you're not hitting those metrics and measures, that sets up a whole bunch of root cause analysis or other conversations to force a change in operating in some way, shape, or form. But inevitably in every one of these businesses, there are trade-offs being made. And sometimes there are elephants in the room that people don't want to discuss. And it could be something as fundamental as we don't have great product market fit here. We rolled this out, we released it to customers, and we're finding that our sales team can't close these guys, or they're closing at a very, very low rate. That might inform you that you need to put more features into the product and take another rev, another version, 2.0 or 3.0 before asking sales to do a whole bunch of heavy lifting or banging away on leads in Salesforce or what other, customer relationship management tools being used to go after potential customers. Focus is the big thing here, because you could dilute a product team's efforts with a lot of different things across lots of verticals and never really get good at serving any one of them. And what I found is that it's really critical to get really good at a few things, serving a few cases of customer use cases or verticals. Because once you do that, you can get things that are repeatable. And things that are repeatable can be understood, can be managed, can be resourced confidently. So that's really the trick. When you don't have that going on, you can have inefficiency in an organization. And certainly in Silicon Valley, it's well known that growth is important, but sometimes you have to stop and push back on growth and get better at everyone's day-to-day job before you start growing again. And investors certainly don't like to hear that, because you're always being measured against peer companies who can be growing extraordinarily fast. But sometimes it takes spending that other cycle or two will get you better at serving your core customer base and with the business. And oftentimes that's something a CFO can step into and alleviate tension around and say, well, look, we can't flog our sales team any further. It's just, we don't have the right fit here. We don't have the right collateral here. And you can see that in the data. It becomes less of a, I think, or subjective kind of, set of discussions or arguments between two different departments versus something that's very data driven that just says, nope, we need to work on X, Y, and Z. As soon as we get those things out, then we can start adding more people to the sales team, or then we can start international expansion, whatever it is.
So much of what you're describing is so far out of my skill set. I'm just wondering, what have you found the most challenging part of being CFO?
Well, I think it's sometimes you will step into situations where the pressures to perform or to make some suboptimal decisions have already driven some suboptimal decisions, like international expansion that might be ahead of when it's actually needed. To give a very academic kind of example, if you're growing at 100% per annum selling into the U.S. and the U.S. is believed to be, a $1 billion market, when you're at 10, 20, 30, 50 million in revenue, you probably don't need to yet dilute your attention on expanding internationally. But you'll find sometimes companies without even hitting 10 million in revenue will have a half dozen or more offices on three or more continents and a whole bunch of complexity. And you're stepping in as CFO into that situation, and I can speak from direct experience, and you're having to look at something that's tough to manage, doesn't make a whole lot of economic sense, and you've got to figure out how to bring that to light and get the right set of decisions made without making people feel like fingers are being pointed at them. That's the tough job, is when you do need to bring accountability for decisions that were suboptimal. It's, my approach in that is, don't focus on the who did what or why or what was in the rear view. Just look at the data you've got and craft the best plan forward. And that's really the trick here, is to get people to be informed from the past, not dwell on it, but use that information to guide the future and to be better in the future. Easier said than done sometimes.
Yeah, no, I'm just thinking of my own experience with Storybox and how hard it's been to maintain that laser focus on things, and you start to get diluted, you start to focus on too much and you lose focus, or it just it feels like this constant juggling act. And so what you're describing seems like such a crucial skill, to be able to balance where the focus is and I can imagine how challenging that must be.
In enterprise sales in particular, and I say enterprise, I should say business to business sales, you see a lot of companies selling that launch a product, sell to small and medium sized businesses that might be companies with 50 to a few hundred employees. They get a lot of traction, they have a lot of success doing that, and then it gets stuck in someone's head that if they just sold to larger companies like HP or Oracle or Dell or General Motors, that they could do you know, their contract sizes would increase exponentially. And that's true, but to get there requires almost an entirely different way of approaching a customer, approaching marketing. It's essentially launching almost an entire business outside of the specific. And in many cases, you have to launch a different product too. I see that desire to go big because the numbers are bigger sometimes pull companies away from getting really, really good at solving a specific problem. And you can do that with small customers or large ones. And the really good ones find out that they serve a need that, you know, transcends small and large organizations. And those are the ones that generally have those meteoric growth rates that, you know, continue from 50 million to 100 million and beyond.
That's awesome. And let's, you know, I love learning more about career paths just to give people that tangible feel of one example of how to go from the military to a high up position like a CFO. I'm wondering, so when you first got out of the military, you did a year of consulting. How did that happen? Like, what was that initial job search process like? And any advice you'd share for veterans in that very first job out of the military?
So when I was approaching my search and when I made the decision in my head to leave the military, I thought I wanted to go to business school because I thought that would be a way to formally acquire some additional business skills and maybe close a gap with my peers that had graduated from universities in 1993, which is when I graduated from the Naval Academy. And as I looked at different opportunities, I went through some military recruiters like the Lucas Group, had good experience. I used the Service Academy career conferences to meet with a bunch of high quality companies. And then I also leveraged my brother, who was actually graduating from the University of Virginia at that time. And he was going into consulting, and he kind of sold me on the benefits of going to consulting because I would get a chance to likely work with at least a handful of clients in anywhere from 3 to maybe 6 month engagements in a variety of different industries. And so it'd be an accelerated view into business and different flavors of business. And ultimately, I was able to find a role in Anderson Consulting. I sourced that myself and felt that was going to prepare me very well for business school. And it did. It enabled me to contribute in the case learning environment at Harvard, where people oftentimes are expected to bring more of their practical work experience into the classroom than they are to bring lessons from a textbook, and enabled me to contribute in a way that I couldn't have done if I was just talking about my experience with a platoon at SEAL Team 8 or working in the Pentagon. It's very different. So I very much benefited from that little over a year in consulting, and I think my classmates probably benefited from me being able to talk a little bit more about corporate America.
Yeah, I'm just thinking in my own experience, I went straight from the Navy to business school, and it was just for such a high, I've never calculated the per day cost of my MBA, but imagine it's pretty high. And it's like, I just think so much of that high expense time was spent learning just such basics. And if I had had a year, especially of consulting, because it seems like that's such a efficient way to get a lot of experience in a short amount of time, I would have gotten so much more value out of my MBA experience. And even the classes, I was just learning the lowest tier of knowledge to gain from any case that we studied. And what I'm jealous of from your experience is having just had that actual real world work experience and having a little bit of industry experience. I just imagine you, like you said, you added more value in class, but I think you probably extracted at a much higher level in that learning experience than I was able to.
It definitely benefited me. I think everyone's experience is probably a little bit different. And it also depends on the program you go to. HBS with the case method they give you textbooks, but they don't rely that heavily on text and preparation in advance of a class. You learn as much from maybe more from your classmates than you do even the teachers or the textbooks in those sessions. Other schools with more of an approach, maybe more of a reliance on textbooks, that prior experience might not be might not be that that critical or as beneficial. I certainly know for myself, I really hated not having textbooks for a lot of these classes because I wanted to close the gap with someone who had worked at JP Morgan in banking for 4 years, and there was just no way I was gonna. But I would have tried. I would have read the books.
And how did you decide on finance? Like, at what point in business school, or maybe even before business school, did you think that finance would be a good industry for you?
It was after business school, and it was after I had survived my, I think, third round of layoffs and consulting that I realized that people on Wall Street, and I was reading research reports being written, and this was in the wake of the dot-com bubble bursting. I was recognizing that the folks in Wall Street were not maybe as familiar with basic business processes and practices they were covering and giving investment opinions on. And I saw from my employer at Scient, where they were still writing very favorably, while I could see inside that the company was facing serious challenges. The types of businesses it had been supporting in the past were going away. It needed to develop more traditional consulting skills and systems implementation capability that Accenture and Deloitte and other EDS, other technology companies have been offering for decades, and they were never going to be able to close that capability gap. But in Wall Street, everything was still being written about it, and people are being told, oh, things are fine, and here's the reason why you need to buy this stock. And what I thought was, having worked in a bunch of different industries, seen that, had that own firsthand experience of Wall Street kind of missing the implosion, I thought, well, maybe I could actually go into finance, leverage what I know about how companies work, and maybe have an edge, maybe do it better, or at least be differentiated, if nothing else. So that's what led me to not go back into consulting and find a job at a small buy-side shop, investment shop in San Francisco.
You know, what strikes me when you say that is, because I'm a big planner, and so I keep on thinking in these interviews of like, oh, you know, figuring out what you want to do and planning for that, and then realizing how much is determined by timing as well. And so, you talked about when you were graduating and like there's all these layoffs in consulting, and that was a similar experience for me when I graduated from business school. And, you know, I spoke with someone earlier today who went into finance, you know, derivatives in finance right in 2008 when everything, you know, just like the worst possible timing. And so it's just a good reminder too of like, despite all the best preparation, all the best plans, and kind of setting your intention in stone, and then there's just all of these things outside of our control that can have a dramatic impact on your career progression. And so it's just interesting that was, you know, some component of what drew you to finance was just the macro trends and everything going on at the time that was so outside of everyone's control.
You know, that's exactly true. I don't know that I've gotten at peace or come to peace with that reality that there are things outside my control. I think I operate as a CFO sometimes, trying to control everything if necessary, which, you know, leads to 24 hour days sometimes. But you're absolutely right that it luck or fate will play some element in all of this. But I think if you can develop a 5-year view with some degree of confidence of where you want to be, and you look at what are the skills and experience you need to have that ideal job or to be positioned the way you want to be positioned. If you don't focus on the sequencing of picking those things up, but just trying to pick those bits up as you go along and see how they're offered to you, you may be able to kind of keep your sanity while things appear to be kind of, you know, going that circuitous route.
Yeah, totally. And what about, you know, in terms of sequencing then, what would you want people to know about your path from entering finance into becoming a CFO? Just kind of what were some of the major steps along the way and the things you learned to build up the skill set to be that chief financial officer?
Well, certainly getting into investment banking has been hugely helpful. If you go into a standard investment banking program, whether it's at a bulge bracket bank, the like big ones like Morgan Stanley or Goldman, down to smaller firms. I was at a group called Thomas Weisel Partners. I also worked at Citibank. You can't help yourself, or you won't be unable to do anything other than be a super strong Excel user and financial modeler. And those skills become really, really helpful when you're a CFO, because you've already had the experience of trying to take the operations of a company and figure out why it makes sense to buy it and or sell it. But now you're in that CFO seat and you're having to basically, you know, sell yourself on the opportunity, sell your employees on the opportunity to stay there and why they're creating something of value, and giving your board confidence about that investment thesis as well. The Wall Street experience has been, you know, tremendously, tremendously helpful. It certainly enables me when I'm running financing processes and venture-backed companies generally get funded with checks that last about 2 to 2.5 years. Knowing how to go out and run that process to ask institutions for more money is certainly a great thing for a CFO toolkit. The other thing I did that was, you know, formal training post-business school was to get a CFA, which is a chartered financial analyst designation. It's a process that used to take 3 years if you took every exam and passed every exam the first time. I think now you can actually take the exams maybe every 6 months and get through it faster, but it's all about investment management. It's a lot of quantitative tools and skills around different types of investments, but it takes the accounting side of things and then the finance you may have learned before and puts an exclamation point at the end of it in terms of, I would say, credibility and capability to step into almost any situation where dollars or pounds or you name the currency is being discussed, and actually be able to develop frameworks to get to decisions, to assess situations, and to figure out, you know, is this thing working? Is this thing valuable?
That's great. And what are some, I'm wondering, obviously anything is possible, right? I'm sure that there's examples of people who have become CFOs from every conceivable background, but I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on what are some more tried and true ways for, or career paths for someone to become a CFO. And I'm particularly interested in, is an MBA like almost a requirement, or is that just one of many potential ways to eventually become a CFO?
Yeah, having an MBA isn't a requirement at all. I think the traditional tracks to getting into the CFO seat have been through the normal kind of finance and accounting role, where you might have had a finance undergraduate degree, worked in a finance department at a company in, it could be financial planning analysis to start, where you're a low-level analyst, or it could be doing collections, taking customer sales orders and invoicing and then getting payment for them. But they're low-level accounting roles in companies. As you demonstrate mastery there, you rise up through the rank structure, so to speak, and can find yourself being a controller, which is generally somebody who kind of knows the numbers and can produce good numbers. And then above that, there are different types of titles, director of finance, vice president of finance, or CFO. And those roles are generally the ones that are making sense of the numbers. And that's the kind of traditional track if you came up in a finance organization. There are also accounting firms, KPMG, PwC, Ernst & Young, that take accounting types, have them work on lots of client engagements over the course of their careers. And you'll generally see those people kind of mid-career at maybe the manager level or partner level, moving over into companies either as a controller or maybe a director of finance working for a CFO, but then after several years of experience getting the opportunity to be the senior guy, a senior financial leader at those companies. Those are the more traditional routes. I think in the last 5 years or so, you've seen more people come out of investment banking, either bankers or folks in equity research getting CFO seats, and not having a stint working underneath the CFO. That's, typically more common with private companies. There's a little more scrutiny required for larger public companies. It's just a little more of a headache in facilitating that, but it's not impossible. But you're seeing more and more of that with the banking world.
That's great. And what about if someone's listening to this and they just think that what you're describing sounds awesome and they think that they might want to go down that that finance route into the role of a CFO, what are some indications that they might really like serving as a CFO and be well suited for it? And what are some indications that it might not be the right choice for them or they might not enjoy it?
Yeah. Good question. I think you've got to, you know, first and foremost, you have to like numbers, and you have to find working in Excel to be an enjoyable experience. And it's not just working in the numbers, but you have to be someone that puts together things in an accurate manner. If you constantly have things where you're erasing stuff, saying, whoopsie, let me change that up, I gave you the wrong one. Finance, CFOs, and certainly an investment bank, it really requires a high degree of accuracy, like first time right every time. And you've got to build in process to get you there. I mean, that's not me out of the box for sure. But aside from that, enjoyment of numbers and having things right and accurate, you've got to be able to handle stress, because there's a lot of it. If in the banking industry, you can be responsible for things that, tens of hundreds of millions of dollars going here and there, and a mistake can, you know, have more than seven figure, you know, can be a more than seven figure mistake. Those are just horrific goofs. And if you're not sure, that's going to create a lot of pressure, and you're going to have a sweaty brow until you figure things out. In the private company world, and I mentioned that these companies are typically on 2 to 2.5 year funding cycles. If you don't get the next check in, the entity may go belly up. There's all the person that feels the most pressure around that situation is the CFO, because you're looking at payroll, you're looking at vendor payments, you're looking at office lighting, and you've got better visibility into when things reach what's called cash exhaustion than anyone. And you expect CEOs to be very optimistic, heads of sales to be very optimistic and believing it will come. But when you're not seeing it, when you're not holding the sales order, and you've got a backlog of payments, that can be pretty nerve-wracking. Mm-hmm. But you can also thrive on the fact that in some situations, the weight of the company is on your shoulders. And, that for me, that's highly motivational. I tend to view my job as one that supports others, and I'm thinking about the not just my colleagues, but their families too. It motivates me to make sure we never get to that point where I'm wondering, is the money gonna run out? Do we have enough funding? Have we expanded our loan agreement enough to provide enough operating wiggle room? I never want to be in those situations, but they're not entirely unavoidable, and they can be super stressful. If that doesn't sound good to you, I think there are tons of things that you can do at private companies that don't require that. And there are many days where I ask myself, is this really what I want to keep doing? I still have those moments too.
And as you say that, I realize, like, not only does it sound like the CFO role at any company would be stressful, but you layer on top of that the stress of any startup and any company, like you said, where it's like literally you have 2 years and you're out of capital. And so it just seems like you're compounding that even more. And it makes me realize too, like, the CEO, at least traditionally, their job is to have that reality distortion feel. Their job is to project enthusiasm and fire up the troops and fire up investors and get everyone dreaming big and thinking about the impossible. And in some way, you're like the conservative parent. You're the one who has to be the adult in the room and impose reality and make sure that they're not overextending or that they're not promising things that are impossible. So, when you explain it like that, it just seems like that stress component is, that seems like one of the most stressful jobs I can imagine, of just juggling all of that at the same time. So that's certainly takes a specific type.
Yeah, there are elements of that might sound unappealing, but when we first started talking about the CFO's role, and I was talking about kind of alignment, and you take the strategy, you get a business plan together, and then you drive activities to execute across the business plan, it's kind of analogous to having a glide slope. You've got your vision, you know where you want to land. And in those situations, when you're below glide slope, the CFO is going to be saying, hey, we're below glide slope, power, 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 or you know, pull up, whatever the corrective action is. In these scenarios where you are running out of money, that there's also that's going to happen anyway. When it's just, you know, maybe it's also exhilarating is when you have to step in and be the guy delivering confidence, saying, yes, the cash is running out, but we have hit all these milestones. I'm confident the next financing is going to happen. The valuation of the company is going to increase. Here's why, team, don't get distracted by what you see on the balance sheet or the financial report right now. Don't worry. That's a good position to be in. And that's where you can create some real confidence in the organization and real on a personal level, create some very strong bonds with the people working for you, because people will inevitably worry when you start to get 18, 24 months past a financing. They're going to be looking and saying, John, how are we doing here? You know, the Series D was in 2014. Are we okay? Are we okay? Yep, looking good. We're nailing it. You just keep, you know, delivering those product features. Just keep landing those customers. I'll deal with the bank account. It's much more enjoyable when you've got things working and you can kind of be a source of confidence for the organization.
That's awesome. And you know, I'm wondering, as you look back, especially out of the your first couple years out of the military, in what ways did you feel like because of your military service you were ahead of your civilian counterparts, and in what ways did you feel like you had to play catch up?
I think where I was ahead was, I think, in the bucket of managerial or leadership skill, which a lot of that stems from work ethic. And I was able to prove myself to be incredibly reliable, confident and unafraid. So I would ask questions when things weren't going right. I think some of my colleagues would steer away from the conversation or the topic. I wasn't afraid to enter to tee up the topic, because my view was, well, we got to figure this thing out at some point in time. And if this thing's going to work out in the future, if the client project's going to work out, we're going to have to have solved this. So let's just get in there and tackle it. I don't have any idea how to do it, but I'm game for direction. I'm game for trying whatever idea is being proposed. I think those kind of skills enabled me to develop a pretty good bond with my seniors, who found me to be hardworking, reliable. If I throw John at this problem, he may not get it right away, but he's got an approach where he'll lay siege to it. He'll put in the time necessary to solve it. And oh, by the way, he's also thinking about the challenges that his peers are and colleagues are facing and lending them a hand too. So I think the only thing that I would say I was behind on was a set of specific experiences or skills if you were just doing a purely academic assessment. I hadn't served companies in oil and gas for 4 years. I hadn't been a C-plus developer for 3 years. Some of those skills I was never gonna want to get anyway, because I was beyond the point that they would be important or utilized in my role. But I think it was probably a somewhere around the 10-year point that I think I felt like I was starting to catch up with folks that hadn't gone into the military and had a normal university experience.
And you know, that makes me think about just kind of habits, like positive and negative. And I'm wondering, when you look back on your military experience, what were some of the positive habits that you've tried to maintain that help you in the civilian workforce? And are there any habits that you had to break, you know, things that you did in the military where you really needed to actively think about trying to change your behavior once you got out?
I think that the most important habits have probably been those basics. I feel like I'm using that term work ethic a lot, but the getting up early, I generally try to be first guy in at the companies and the last guy to leave. I think hopefully I'm productive in between those two events, but that's definitely, I think, given me a lot of you know, leadership by example, credibility with my colleagues, and not all people maybe share that same kind of commitments to an organization. I believe the more senior you are, I don't think you can have people questioning your commitment to the organization or whether or not you're the startup is maybe some kind of lifestyle decision for you. They're fundamentally they can't exist or shouldn't exist with each other, be incompatible, but I've seen companies where that's not the case. But I think those basic habits of getting up early and thinking about others, not just breaking your pile of rocks if you've got that kind of a job, but looking over your shoulder and trying to figure out, okay, how is what I'm doing going to benefit the person next to me or the person in that office on the other side of the country? I think it's that orientation to the team that just comes natural, I think, for military veterans. That's been the thing I've probably relied on the most. I think the thing I have had to probably restrain a little bit is maybe the candor or my willingness to run into something that might look like a cluster. And certainly, you know, in this environment, I think, this day and age, the swearing like the sailor, it's probably out of the Navy now, but certainly out of the corporate world too. But people definitely appreciate candor. I think it's all in kind of the tone. And I found that even the fearlessness and willingness to attack the elephant in the room or the forbidden subject, I think more often than not, that's gained me the admiration of peers and colleagues more than it's hurt me.
That's great. And I imagine too that the startup world prizes that candor and straightness more. Maybe that's not true. I don't know, but I can imagine that in the Bay Area in particular, that it's very open to kind of more direct feedback, though maybe it is have to be cushioned more or a little bit more softened. But that is interesting. And
I think some of that may be, you know, I get lots of training because I'm the gray hair in the office around how to quote unquote deal with millennials. But what I have found and what motivates me is I'm fortunate to, you know, where I am today is, I'm sure it's got something to do with me, but it's got more to do with the people I've been able to work with. And I've been able to either surround myself with or have the privilege of working with that were maybe, you know, that took a chance on me and hired me. But I find the biggest motivation to be, you know, some of my younger colleagues who were smart, hardworking, thoughtful, and ask, you know, great questions. That drives me more than, you know, more than anything else in the company. And I find that in many cases, it's the inexperienced folks trying to talk through a situation that lead to more insights than a couple of members in an executive team, you know, sitting in a corner for an hour, you know, chewing the fat or, you know, contemplating their navels or staring at a whiteboard.
and what about, and this could be from your own transition to civilian life, or I just imagine you've run across a lot of veterans who have gone through this transition as well. What do you think are some of the more surprising aspects about the transition to civilian life, or put differently, if someone's listening on active duty, what might they not know to expect about what that transition is going to be like or what life on the other side is going to look like?
I think there are a couple things to consider. I think first it's going to feel awkward. There's just no way around that. It's going to be different. You're going to have some freedoms you didn't have before. There's going to be stuff that people don't care about that used to occupy a lot of your time when you were quote unquote on the job. I think that the trick is first to realize that your first job is probably not going to be your ideal job. It's going to be a pathway towards something, and figuring out that something is really critical. What do you think you might want to be doing 5 years down the road? If you can get a view of that, then it just becomes trying to get in a position, get an initial role that will enable you to amass some of those experiences that are likely to be required when you're thinking about that point in 5 years out. And for me, the tough part in this was, even when I knew I was going to business school and I was doing the work at Accenture, and this certainly was true after business school, was trying to get a sense of kind of purpose in that career path. It was hard to do. And it took a few, you know, cycles and soul searching myself to figure out, well, what I want to be later in life. I always thought I wanted to be a very competent manager with a broad skill set, even though I'm kind of deep in finance. I think of myself first and foremost as a manager. That was kind of what I figured out was going to be my guiding light. And I thought it could be a consulting partner, or it could be operating in some customer facing department somewhere, but that's kind of where I thought I wanted to go. So then it was just a question of trying to pick up skills and experiences that would benefit somebody in that role. That was really what was helpful for me, because just taking a job and not really knowing where you're going, that could be a real struggle, and just feel like I'm just doing the 9-to-5 grind, or I've got my pile of rocks. I break rocks between, you know, 8 and 5 every day. That's not going to be motivating or fulfilling, particularly for veterans who, you know, over the last, you know, current decade and prior have just had an amazing set of experiences with tremendous purpose. Right. I mean, I'm so appreciative for, you know, anyone listening to this, that's been serving, recently, because, it's a dramatically different environment than when I was in, and it's going to be hard to get that sense of personal satisfaction and fulfillment.
So, I love a lot about what you were saying, and one of the things that strikes me is I really like what you were saying about that you don't have to figure out where you're going to be in 20 years, you know, like minimize that pressure. And I like that thought of looking maybe 5 years ahead. And I realize in thinking of you as an example, I keep on viewing you as like you were a CFO, and then like, you know, maybe that's what you knew you were going to do all along. But in hearing your story, it's kind of like you're making one decision after another. You're taking the information you have, and you're making the decision for what you want to do next. But it's not like you always knew you were going to be a CFO and you were strategizing on how to get there. And I think that hopefully that minimizes the pressure for people listening to think that you don't have to have it all figured out. Just make the best decision based on the information you have and kind of take it one step at a time.
Yeah, that's very true. I never thought I would be a CFO, and I don't think CFO will be my final ending place either. But what I tried to do was amass a set of experiences that I thought would make me a more competent business manager. And as I think I said earlier, I've picked up a lot in the financial realm of things, but I look to broaden myself further, and if certainly as a CFO, sought out experiences and opportunities to manage things that are non-traditional when it comes to CFO career path, including things like sales operations, business development, customer success. I'm still very much trying to learn and trying to get more experiences and stretch myself to become just a better business person.
That's great. And I imagine it's always easy to remain in, I know for myself, it's always easy to remain in my comfort zone. And I kind of, you know, get close to mastering a skill, and it's so easy just to try and stay there and milk that for everything it's worth. And yet at the same time, I know that the most enjoyment and fulfillment and growth I've had is when I push myself out of my comfort zone. And so it's refreshing to hear you say that, you know, you're thinking about things that are non-CFO related, because in my mind I'm kind of like, well, you've nailed such an incredible position, I just imagine you would stay in that sort of role forever, and that I imagine that also wouldn't be much fun, and you're not learning and challenging yourself and growing in different ways. And so I think that's also a good reminder for listeners.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's some people that are wired and happy to do that and get, you know, very specialized. They do that really well, and it can be, you know, it can be easy when you get really good like that, or you can continue to, you know, challenge yourself with that unique set of experiences. I think I'm probably wired to seeking out new challenges and maybe getting bored, or certainly I question myself if I start feeling comfortable, if there's something wrong with me. And I think that shaped a lot of what I've done and where I am currently and what I'm looking to do in the future.
Awesome. Well, I always like to end on a more open-ended question, and I appreciate all the advice you've given in terms of finance and CFO and career progression. I'm just wondering, is there anything I didn't ask about, be it personal or professional, that you'd want to share with veterans? Any advice about anything they might be interested in that we didn't cover already?
I think the big thing, you know, is I think back to making this decision to leave the military and go into the corporate world 20 years ago. Everyone in the audience should just believe me when I tell them that they'll be able to do whatever the job is they get. They'll be able to do it and do it well. And so take confidence with them, because they've been doing the hardest jobs in the world, and they've been doing that extraordinarily well. Nothing in corporate America is going to compare to, you know, to a bad day that they've seen. Even though that there may be some uncertainty around where I'm going to be longer term, or is this the right role, they will be able to do it well. What's required in corporate America, it really is just some basic things. And if you've been a successful military leader, and whether enlisted or officer, you're going to be able to deliver what's required to your next employer.
That's great. And I appreciate, you know, not only the advice you've given along those lines, but I appreciate the example you are, in that, you know, when you're talking about just, you know, that veterans are well suited to dive in and through hard work figure it out, you've also exemplified that in your work in consulting, and then at business school, and then in finance, of just continuously putting yourself in a new environment and figuring it out. So I appreciate also, you know, you're serving as a role model for someone who has just really thrown himself into a variety of different careers and succeeded at that. So thank you for your time, and thank you for your example on the show.
Now, thank you, Justin. A real privilege to and honor to be a part of it.
Surface.
Thanks for listening. Before you go, three important announcements. First, if you believe in what I'm doing and believe in supporting veterans in their careers, please, please, please help me spread the word. The best way I know to do that right now is by taking 18 seconds to write a review on iTunes. It would mean a lot. Second, based on my interviews, I'd advise any and all veterans to look at servicetoschool.org and the American Corporate Partners. Both are completely free for veterans and give you a lot of great resources for your education or professional life, respectively. Third, there are a ton of other great interviews, resources, and data at beyondtheuniform.io. Check it out, share it with your friends, and drop me a line if you have any feedback, because I'd love to hear from you. Thanks, and see you on the next interview.